Before I begin, I'd just like to do the usual acknowledgements. And we certainly have been on a roadway that has had a lot of bumps. Thanks, good. Here I just have a few names and some of the key players. And the reason I start with these on the initial roadway of Phil Moncrief, a retired public health advisor, Kimberly Quinn and Stacy Shiver, who are folks that still work with me. And a very, very, very long list that would take many slides of the stakeholders that helped us get to the point where we were in terms of developing a framework to work on and help us with our support in bringing forth the rule promulgation process. Most recently, after we put out our rule, we have, of course, Adrian Cooksey, who's in our office, an epidemiologist, and I benefited from a technical advisory visit from our colleagues at CDC, Sarah Foran, Sammy Gottlieb, and, of course, Lori Markowitz, who didn't come but was on the phone. And we have many, many colleagues within the department in terms of areas like breast and cervical cancer, the cancer registry folks, some of our colleagues that are researchers throughout the state. What was my goal? And I say my goal because I had both the privilege and the burden of driving this. When Heidi mentions the public health champion, sometimes that is what it takes. And you start on a pathway and you have absolutely no idea it's going to be that difficult for you or take that long. I really wanted to create and drive an opportunity for baseline surveillance data on high-risk HPV strains, abnormal cytologies, and histologies. But more importantly, in many ways, because I knew lots of other people like Cosette would do that, I wanted to create a viable surveillance system that would support future analyses linked to STD issues and data in a broader picture. Reminding ourselves, HPV is an STD. It fits in the context of behaviors that allow you to acquire comparable bugs, you know, in the same family, they get there the same way, etc. So I wanted to gain further understanding or build a surveillance system that would allow us at some point to have a further understanding of the natural history, notably in the presence of comorbidity with other STDs at the population level. Why do I hone in on this? Because much of what I read in the 10 years before this did not control for other STIs in populations, or they were specific to clinic study populations, but not population groups like we would have in a true STD morbidity reporting environment. And of course, everybody I worked with was gung-ho to evaluate HPV vaccine efficacy. So that was a factor. As a note, we started out both with the privilege and the burden. I was very interested in driving this public health policy issue and stepped to the plate and said, I'll do it for my department. Yeah. 2 years later, we ended up with a complete massive rewrite of our administrative code for reportable conditions. We had a lot of goals in that process that were much bigger than HPV. HPV and abnormal PAPs, you know, were just a little tiny piece in this, to put it into context. Hence why it took so long and became so big. We needed to reduce language redundancy, enhance our communicable disease reporting. As you know, like specifically reporting timeframes, we had about 10 of them, ranging from you know, a few days to several 6 months. We wanted to arrive at a single practitioner report form. We had multiple, thanks to our peers at CDC, multiple report forms, I might add. We wanted to clarify a lot of the testing requirements that seemed to be gray and muddy in text by placing them all in a table. And of course, we had new statutory requirements that is always part of the process when you're in a public health agency. We also very much wanted to mandate electronic lab reporting at a high-level HL7. Some of the specific policy issues besides HPV reporting and related abnormal PAPs were child abuse reporting, public health preparedness, and other some of the other HPV issues that you note, the recurrent papilloma, Okay, there's a stutter word start. Okay, hang on a second here. I know I had a note I wanted to remind myself. Oh, on the statutory, some of the big issues that overlapped in here, and actually I mentioned, not because they were HPV, but because they were a real factor in how long it took us. We had a major law change around perinatal issues, the authority to test in pregnancy. We wanted that expanded. As a result, at one point, when a year and a half into this process, when we were ready to roll out in June of 06, I had the pleasant surprise of a 10-month challenge from the Florida Hospital Association. And while I would have loved to move this rule forward, that was much too important an issue that had to be resolved, because the testing authority for us in public health for testing during pregnancy was a critical piece that we wanted to resolve. Prior to this, we could only collect blood specimens, which of course doesn't help us in today's environment with many other test technologies. So where are we as far as HPV specifically? Both the laboratories and the practitioners, through a passive report system, report to us at the Bureau of Sexually Transmitted Diseases. Very different than in some other areas. This is not, you know, pilot, active going out and gathering the data, as we learned from a lot of the presentations this morning in the context of the extensive efforts done by CDC with a lot of the studies. From practitioners, we ask that they only report high-risk HPV strains. And I'll come back to this in a moment, because you'll probably ask, well, why in God's name did I want this? I had some reasons. I've learned that they probably weren't real good. But anyway, sometimes you have to learn these things along the way, right? Laboratories, we ask them to report any DNA typing of high-risk strains. And that was not, you know, technology-specific, but all strains, in order that it would allow for growth with whatever technologies might evolve in the years ahead. And abnormal cytologies and histologies is a note. A year later, we really spent the first year, we rolled out on November 20th of 06, and we spent all of 07 for the most part promulgating this huge administrative code rewrite to our laboratory and professional practitioner groups. A lot of things were developed to mail out in terms of booklets, pamphlets that went to every licensed practitioner, to every licensed laboratory. We made a lot of site visits. We made a lot of public presentations to professional groups to clarify these new guidelines. So at the end of November, in the summer, in sought the assistance from CDC to help us kind of look at this, and it was a joint effort, an offer and a request for assistance to look at where we were with what we were setting up, particularly to streamline some of the functionality that we had at that point, or did not have at that point, and address, as you know, our practitioner and laboratory data quality, and definitely address the case definition. That was an area that I struggled very much with. You know, it's one thing to say, report all abnormal cytologies and histologies. Getting into the nuts and the bolts of the details of how you want that information communicated. And keep this in context. I didn't want paper. No one in my office wanted paper. Mr. Shiver sitting back there, he would have killed me if I had said paper. We were going for HL7 reporting, and we were willing to wait 12 months, if that's what it took, till we could negotiate with labs and get all of that. Now, that's our criteria that's in the administrative code, but it's not quite as, you know, it's not easy. You don't just put it in a code and it doesn't just happen overnight. There's a lot of nuances here, a lot of working with laboratory partners and getting us to that point. We've made great progress. We nightly, this slide actually was made a few days before we had a big upload change, but where this laboratory data is at the moment, if I'm not mistaken, we are almost 3,000 lab results a night being loaded, right, Stacy? 3,000 every single night are coming into us. We don't yet even have cytologies and histologies coming in electronically. That is from several major labs. We looked at our six major lab partners that had probably between 70 and 80% of our STD positive results. We focused on those for the first year. The second tier of, you know, another, say, 10 to 15% come from a moderate labs, the kind of practices that, you know, go into a hospital basin area, catchment area, or they might be like a standing pathology associates that have been around forever and have, you know, 15 pathologists on board. And the rest of the small, tiny, doc-in-the-box, single-individual practitioner offices will make up the remaining probably 8% of our reportable sources. We, in addition to the nearly 3,000 positive results we're now getting at night, we have daily around 4,000 negative public health screens that just, this is a side note, that help us through the application to inform persons that have actually had a screening in the field what were their test results. They show up in a task list within our application called PRISM. And an additional item that we have that is a value to this context of HPV reporting is an annual aggregate report. What do I mean by that? In the administrative code, there's a requirement that once a year, all licensed laboratories, and that includes laboratories that process specimens outside of Florida, because the law in Florida pertains, as it does in many states, if the specimen is collected in Florida, they're obliged to report it, regardless of where it's processed. They also then have to report in this annual aggregate report the total volume of specific tests in the that they perform. For example, all of the full spectrum of chlamydia tests that they would perform in an aggregate form, just in terms of gender and number, the usual demographics, but of course stripped of name identifiers. That has been our longstanding way to kind of keep our hands around the volume of testing that occurs. We had in November, when we were working with our partners from CDC, around 2,500 responses. That number's actually doubled now, and so I forgot to update that number. Those were ones that came in on the fax machine right into my office. They, as we noted, had quite a variability in quality and the content and their ultimate utility to us over the long term. What was valuable about them was learning what probably wasn't going to be useful to us. That was probably the biggest lesson from that. But key to it was also recognizing the need to retain one key group of practitioners, which I will get to right now in our revised case definition. We also did note, of course, as you see here, they've reported both high and low risk results. They often attach the laboratory results was far more valuable because we could actually look at the lab results, and that helped us in our further analysis in November. And the treatment field was so often left blank, or it had anything from what was their next step, which might mean colpo and biopsy, which really wasn't related to treatment in any way. I say treatment because that's a box on our unified disease reporting form, so that was really the only place they could put it. And right about this time, as we were really looking at this data in depth with our peers, we got a challenge to the code that practitioners didn't want to report. Well, when you consider we have a state of 17 million, we have almost 2-to-1 lawyers for doctors in the state, but we still have oodles and oodles of doctors and oodles of PAPs going on each year. The fact that we only got in around by the end of the year, it was closer to, almost 4,000, as I say, it's about 5,000 of these faxed forms. We still weren't getting them from hardly any OBs or gyns. It was the OB-GYNs that protested the code. We were mostly getting them from family practice offices and from nurse practitioners who'd taken it to heart that they had a requirement to report. Perhaps this nurse practitioner giving that message in a couple of forums was helpful, I don't know. The code challenge, in some ways, I wasn't real worried about, because thanks to our definition, which I've got to pass out there in a little bit whenever you're leaving or whatever, so we don't disrupt, but as noted in our summary minutes from our meeting that Dr. Foran provided, the complex challenge with the development of the case definition was looking at the two layers, the distinguishing the test, the HPV test, or in the matter of the PAP or the histology, and identifying the subsets that would report us or would give us in that reportable process a yield that would be useful for analysis. In the end, we addressed on that algorithm that came out of our work together, I think what was very helpful, and I'll just sum it real quick for you, a revised case definition requirement for reporting, which is now in our code process again, and that is promulgating through the state. So we're doing revisions on our administrative code, and this revised case definition has been included in that to further clarify. For laboratories, there's the positive test for any HPV risk. I don't think I put that. No, I didn't. Go back. I just have to read this to you. I'm sorry. But it was too much to stick up there in fine print. And that's for any high-risk HPV strain. And your abnormal cervical and anogenital cytology is consistent with Bethesda. This goes the scope from, you know, your ascus, your SIL on through CIN3. And your abnormal histologies with the specifics being broken out here in terms of your CIN1, 2, and 3, or carcinoma in situ, the adenocarcinoma in situ, the AIS, your vulvar intraepithelial neoplasia, your vaginal intraepithelial neoplasia, and your anal intraepithelial neoplasia. So, and key to this as we went about finalizing this revised definition was to excuse all practitioners from reporting except one group, pathologists. Because in our state, of course, pathologists are licensed both as lab directors and as medical providers. It was critical to keep that medical provider as an entity that had a requirement to report, or we would not capture the critical area of, for the most part, the cytologies and histologies, since they report out of labs under their license, not on a laboratory license. We had received for 2007, after working primarily, as I say, with our largest partner, and that was LabCorp, over 45,000 results. We expect, with the other partners that are coming on board this month and in May, to triple this number by the summer. We will also, from LabCorp, have close to at least doubled, if not tripled, the total reporting from them, because coming over by the summertime will be the abnormal cytologies and histologies. They have been in close negotiation with us. Just as a note to any of you that are interested in this, they've been a wonderful partner. Tribute to Mr. Shiver, who's got good skills at negotiating this kind of stuff as well. But they've worked very, very well with us. And part of what they're doing at the moment is, as they've looked at these requests from several other states, they're making sure that the requests coming from other states are going to be supported by the HL7 format that we're asking for the reporting to occur in, so that they can be rolling out, you know, development activities that will support several states and not just Florida. We're pleased with the HPV data that we're getting that's coming in per the standards that we've defined. And as a note, the Pap and histology are still in test. We've also begun working with a methodology to transmit from these moderate size groups. Those are the ones that are like a pathology associates group that might have, you know, 10, 15 pathologists on board. They, of course, are not set up or have not been set up in the past for an HL7 type of transmission. But they have been very, very receptive to working on other approaches. And for lack of Stacy, could you pop in the magic words, the HTP, it would be secure socket stuff. What are some of the other ones? Flat files. Okay, for those of you who understand that, that's flat files, okay? Whatever, but I mean in terms of VPN, secure technology interfaces to assure that we're getting that information. All this stuff comes into our department in a central repository through an integration broker, which is a lab database, and then it's parsed out and picked out or reported automatically into the different applications. We're trying to assure that we have virtually no hands touching this data from the primary source until it arrives in the application where it would be used. So far, I don't have interesting data the way Cosette just was able to offer to you, as we've just been getting to the point of analyzing the data. One of the interesting things from the HPV piece out of LabCorp I thought was of interest was that the age distribution of the reports are comparable in rural and urban areas of the state. This was a question that I asked of the data immediately, because who dies of cervical cancer in our state? Women from rural areas. That's the primary mortality area for us. Always the question has been about poverty and access to care. But also the question in the back of our minds is, I know one of the reasons why we went down this road was how, or over time, you know, what relationship did comorbidity with other STIs potentially play? We don't know, but there's the opportunity to study this now. What we did note in looking at this data, while the distribution of the specimens being collected based on the population rate, you know, the percent of population being screened, was comparable arriving at LabCorp, the age distribution for high-risk strains was almost 2-to-1 amongst rural young women compared to urban young women. Just a finding of note that kind of surprised me. You could look at that two different ways from an STD program management. You could say in a rural area, your sexual network is more contained. You exchange the same partners repeatedly. You have an opportunity for those high-risk strains to be contained in a group. In contrast, you could say when you go into an urban area, you got more partners with more strains, more opportunity to get exposed. Have absolutely no idea what this means. I just found it an interesting observation on our first pass on the data. And as might be expected in terms of natural progression of HPV infection and clearance, we certainly have less at our age 45 and above by about a third, but pretty comparable distribution of high-risk strains in the 24 to 29-year age group. Ah, there's the definition. It was in the wrong place, but you have it on paper now, okay? And I've also began to look at the opportunities for us to interface with the data that exists in our immunization registry and pull that in as a part of matching with the women that are in the application identified as with HPV infection, in order that if they have an STI, we can start to pull in over time whether they have had a HPV vaccine or not. That's at the very beginning stages. We haven't been able to get much done there. They're in the middle of a application replacement, so they're pretty tied up with that. But we do know, since we implemented HPV vaccine distribution in the state through public health last spring, in about May, we have 59% have received their first dose, 30% the second dose, and about 9% the third dose. And you can see the numbers there at 80,000. These are the ones that are covered by your Children for Vaccine and your, the other one, the B17, I'm saying, thank you, 317, thank you. Okay, so wanted to make a point here with this final graphic. I want you all to see my paper money. That's Monopoly money. Money on a tree, money and paper money out of slot machines, and a pretend card deck. Unlike the 500,000 Cosette had, this is how much Florida's had to get this far. Not a penny. It is about driving an issue because you think it's important, and taking a little bit of time out of somebody's day here to make something happen, building something into an application here with just the resources that you have. I do think that this is an area, as Cosette mentioned, that in order for us to make real progress across the country and really understand this over time, it's going to require a funding investment. Where that comes from, I have no idea. But just so you know, we didn't get here because somebody gave us a whole lot of money. Trust me, our state doesn't give us hardly anything. And he topped off my last slide. So it's all right. I had my golden retriever to assist you with your questions, but she's gone. Thank you. Do you have any particular questions for me at this point? Yes. Yes, that comes in that annual aggregate report from each laboratory, so the total volume of tests that they have performed in a calendar year. That's due to us. Correct. An aggregate on the total testing, you'd have to take out. Yeah. Yes. Lori, did you have a question? LabCorp, Stacy, Maya, which were the, all of them in order? You'd better. At the moment, that's pretty about, in terms of the potential volume for reporting, that's around 60, not quite 70 yet. Yeah. Yeah. Correct. No, that was actually, I'm sorry, that number was of all of the results that we received just from LabCorp. That number looked at the number of tests in the different age brackets, like 15 to 19 and so on, based on the population. So the percent of females eligible to have had a test based on the population for rural and urban counties. We looked at that and what were the percent out of each of those that ended up with high risk. Yes, Julie. I think that the questions, the dialogue that happened, if, I don't know if you were in the room for that. I would certainly sort of affirm the findings that Cosette reported and the findings that you, that our colleague over here noted. While we would recommend in standards at the national and at, from our state government and, you know, all the standards that we put out there in terms of which woman, after having an abnormal pap, ought to have a biopsy and how soon that ought to happen, the reality of poverty, transportation, not enough practitioners to perform biopsies in culpos, is the real world out there that we deal with all the time. I don't think Cosette's data is going to change. I think she's going to, and so are we going to show, that there are horrible lags in the point in time from when you have an abnormal pap recommended for biopsy, and that biopsy actually occurs in a large number of women. The health department has, in our state, has, you know, breast and cervical cancer program, family planning programs, prenatal programs. In that context is where those PAPs are collected or an STD clinic. The follow-up is the responsibility of those clinicians. If a PAP with abnormal findings is collected in the private sector, public health has no, doesn't make it their business, no jurisdiction to investigate if a PAP doesn't occur. If that was what your question, I mean, a biopsy doesn't occur, if that was what your question was. We are only responsible for the practitioners that are employed by the department to assure that they meet a standard of care. And the reality is you can endeavor to be responsible, but if you don't have enough clinic slots for access for biopsies and you don't have a way to get a woman's biopsy, you know, paid for, they fall through the cracks, sadly. That's the real world of public health. Yeah. And I think just to add to that, while there's the approach that Cosette has set up there with her colleagues is a PAP registry. Ours is in the context of disease reporting. So it is being received in the department just as one of many reportable conditions. There's no, you know, it's available to our partners, and they worked and supported us in this effort so that at a later date it could be linked into data at the cancer registry and so on at such a point in time when they have funding and ability to do that. Or any of these other ideas. Yes, Laura. Yes, they're in the right now. What happened is it was easiest to work first on the HPV. It's a little cleaner, and so as we worked out the sort of the usual way to transmit the cytologies and histologies was text fields. Well, we didn't want those, you know. We want to define text fields and get all the pathologists to sort of write it the same way in that transmission. And LabCorp's worked with us on this. They really have. This is what's been exciting about it. So. Ultimately, if they're, for example, in that case, LabCorp might be producing both the HPV and the abnormal Pap result or the normal Pap result. Oftentimes, they're coming over right after each other. They're part of the same specimen with a same accession number, just with different results reported on them. The key information that is comparable for any reportable condition is part of this, you know, your name, your date of birth, and so on. So yes, they are getting linked as they're brought into the application for us. Absolutely. I think our examination of the data, this first pass, it absolutely confirms that. It was about a third. A third of it was just done because the young woman said, I want an HPV test. There was nothing else that came in next to her name. Another third had its reflux because of abnormal, and others were just repeat HPV because of an abnormal at a later date. But yeah, we definitely observed those patterns. Yes? Yes, that's part of a required reporting element. However, I will note that we find, as you know, if you go back 10 years, we got 80% of our STD morbidity from public health. Today, we get 80% of our STD morbidity from the private sector. With that, we went from maybe, 1-2% missing race to individual labs, and there are issues here related to labs and provider groups, to between 5 and 10%. It's becoming increasingly challenging to capture race and ethnicity. Added to that, one of the factors that we encountered as we have gone through this process is like that integrated regional lab that Mr. Shiver notes. What's happening there is you got a bunch of hospitals dump into a laboratory partner. They are sort of being viewed as a reference lab to the hospital labs. They strip off all the identifiers, send it into that lab. That lab's reporting. We actually have a legal challenge to them because they are a licensed lab. They must report the identifiers. So we've actually sicked the lawyers on that particular one after months of negotiating, which we don't like to use, but we have that power, and periodically you have to flex your muscles hoping it'll get resolved. Yes, Jeff? Am I okay? No, our statutory authority is for reportable conditions that the department defines, but the way our statute is written, it would imply that it is a condition that's of a public health significance. That's the wording. A negative isn't of public health significance. That is for the purposes of understanding data or, you know, your surveillance analyses or research. We have in another category of law an ability to pursue that further, but when we went out with the massive rule rewrite, we kept really a stringent interpretation of the statute. We do have this option. We can go back for select conditions and ask for the negatives. I'm not prepared to do that personally till we're fully in charge and understand where we are with the data that we've got, because we can always go back and get a lot of it.